This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Uhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
they push the door until they manage to get a space, and they throw their child at canister in the house. There was a smoke. I could not breathe. My eyes were itchy. Pendo's eyes were itchy. You could see her struggling to breathe, rubbing her eyes.
That is the mother of a six-month-old infant that was killed during Kenya's post-election violence last year. Full details on the story coming up.
Also, the U.S. says it strongly disagrees with a decision by the Ethiopian government to impose a state of emergency, and the AU will provide financial and technical assistance to Zimbabwe to help ensure credible elections later this year.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, two teachers' unions have asked the Kenya Teachers Service Commission to withdraw all non-local teachers in the northeastern region of the country until the security situation improves. The request was made by the Kenya National Union of Teachers and Kenya Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers. Their call came 4 days after a suspected Al-Shabaab militant killed two teachers and the wife of one of them in an attack at Karsa Primary School in Wajir, a town on the border of Kenya and Somalia. Rael Ambor reports.
The Kenya Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers Secretary General Akello Misori says the government is not doing enough to protect the teachers working in insecure regions in Kenya.
KUPET now demands that Teacher Service Commission withdraws teachers in those affected regions, those insecure regions, the way they have done in a school in Migori, where teachers have been told to stay at home and the school gate has been closed because the teachers were attacked in that school.
Misori say that various government agencies should work together in the region to ensure security for all residents.
All schools should have a police post, either inside or within the neighborhood. Ministry of Education, Ministry of Interior, Teacher Service Commission, they must work as a team to ensure that teachers in this country do not fear for working in any environment.
The Kenya National Union of Teachers says the Teacher Service Commission should recruit local and trained teachers, saying this would help address teacher shortage in the region and reduce dependence on teachers from other parts of the country. George Musamali, who runs a security company called Executive Protection Services, says this is not a sustainable way to counter the terrorist attacks in the region.
Remember, this is not the first time that we've seen Al-Shabaab targeting non-locals in this kind of attack. And it's a major security issue, and this should be handled by both the local leaders and the government. Because what we are getting from the ground is that the non-locals believe that locals are working with the Al-Shabaab and specifically identifying them for this attack. So I think this is something more serious than it is, and the government needs to act very fast before the situation gets out of hand.
Since early 2015, scores of people have been killed in at least 5 militant attacks in the region.
We cannot blame the government for what is happening because from a security point of view, we will never achieve 100% security. And remember, we've seen this attack, this kind of attack, not only in Kenya, but even in developed world, where the intelligence is top-notch. What needs to happen now is that we need to involve local people more in matters of security.
Most of the Kenyan towns such as Mandera, Wajir, and Lamu, where attacks targeting non-Muslims occur, have an almost 90% Muslim population. The towns share a border with Somalia, and Al-Shabaab recruits have been blamed for infiltrating the communities and radicalizing young men. Abdi Adan is a teacher in Wajir and also the Kenya National Union of Teachers chairman in Wajir County.
If teachers' life is endangered, then they have to look ways and means to secure their own life. So we are not actually giving hand for teachers to withdraw completely from this county. But if necessary, if circumstances forces them, then what should we do?
Al-Shabaab, Somalia's largest militant group, frequently has attacked Kenyan civilian targets in retaliation of Kenya's involvement in a regional military action against it in Somalia. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
A public inquest is underway in Kenya into the brutal killing of a six-month-old baby during last year's post-election unrest. According to the Kenyan National Commission on Human Rights, at least 92 people were killed in the aftermath of the polls, most of them including baby Samatha Pendo by security forces. Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi that while justice for police killings is rare in Kenya, the Pendo family is determined.
Initial investigations by Kenyan police failed to identify the killers of the six-month-old baby Samantha Pendo. A public inquest ordered by the former director of public prosecutions, Keriako Tobiko, began in the city of Kisumu this week to establish how Pendo died. Pendo's mother, Lensa Achieng, took the stand in a packed courtroom Monday. The now mother of one recounted how security forces came to her house in Kisumu.
They pushed the door until they managed to get a space. And they threw their tear gas canister in the house. There was a smoke. I could not breathe. My eyes were itchy. Pendo's eyes were itchy. You could see her struggling to breathe, rubbing her eyes.
Achieng said she tried to find her way outside with the children as the police beat her husband.
The police officer who was in front of me started beating me. The other one beat me at the back. When I was looking behind to see who had beaten me, that stick met my child's head. And immediately, I had Pendo holding me tightly, as if she had a pain. When I look at her, there was a form on her mouth. Her head swollen immediately.
According to pathology reports, Pendo suffered deep head injuries, dying due to internal bleeding. Otsiana Namwai is a researcher with Human Rights Watch. He says there is no guarantee that justice will be served in Pendo's case.
The process of a public inquest means that the regular investigations did not yield any results. They said they could not actually identify the actual police killer. So they recommended a public inquest. The advantage of a public inquest is that it can go beyond the normal investigation. However, the inquest report itself is not binding.
In other words, he said the report could go back to the police, who choose not to conduct a further investigation. Following Pendo's death, Kenya Police Inspector General Joseph Boynet said police were investigating the incident and remarked no sane officer would hit a child. He also said the police response to protests in Kisumu that night in August was lawful and proportionate. Rights groups in Kenya have continually condemned what they consider police brutality.
Why we have so many such cases in Kenya? Partly because the police officers who do these kind of things know that the accountability mechanisms are weak, and there's also no political will to ensure that those who kill unlawfully get prosecuted. So they know that they can get away with it.
As for Pendo's family, they hope they will get the justice that seems so elusive at the moment. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
The U.S. says it strongly disagrees with the decision by the Ethiopian government to impose a state of emergency. The privately owned Addis Standard website reports, quoting a statement issued by the U.S. Embassy in Addis Ababa. The embassy said the U.S. recognizes and shares concerns expressed by the government about incidents of violence and loss of life, but firmly believes that the answer is greater freedom, not less. The state of emergency was imposed last Friday, a day after the resignation of Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn.
The African Union will provide financial and technical assistance to Zimbabwe to help ensure credible elections late this year. The chairperson of the African Union Commission briefed reporters today in Zimbabwe's capital. Sebastian Momfu has the story from Harare.
Briefing reporters at the end of a three-day visit to Zimbabwe, the chairperson of the African Union Commission, Musa Faki Mahamat, said he met separately with former President Robert Mugabe and current President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Speaking through an interpreter, Mahamat discussed his meeting with Mugabe.
Yes, I paid a courtesy visit to former President Mugabe. And since President Mugabe forms part of the heroes who have fought for the liberation of the continent, it's a common heritage for us. And therefore, and this is also recognized even by the authorities of the country. We exchanged views. I found him to be very lucid, and he also explained why he had resigned. It is for peace and the development of the country, and we did discuss very much at ease.
The Chadian diplomat said Mnangagwa's government asked for the African Union to push Western countries, including the United States, to lift sanctions imposed on officials beginning in 2002 following allegations of vote rigging and human rights abuses. The country is headed to elections mid-2018, though no date has been set. Mahamat said the African Union would send technical experts to work with the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission at least a month before the vote. Again, he speaks through an interpreter.
So that these experts, they can work together with the organ in charge of organizing and conducting the elections in the country. We at the same time mobilize partners that can also help in financing the process and also give technical assistance, or both at the same time, that is the financial assistance as well as the technical assistance. This will be our role, the role of the African Union, to make the organ in charge of organizing the elections benefit from the expertise of the African Union in the organization, preparation and organization of the elections.
Analyst Alexander Rusero from Harare Polytechnic College School of Journalism says the AU's offer of support is not surprising.
Because from 2000 up front, Zimbabwe has always been on the headlines, on the agenda, the AU, in as much as its conduct of election was concerned, because the conduct of election in Zimbabwe left a lot to be desired. So given the historical background of the downfall of Mugabe, there must be some semblance of order, there must be some semblance of pursuing democratic ethos, and this can only be done if the election is going to be free and fair.
The opposition says Zimbabwe has not held free and fair elections in nearly two decades. Mugabe was forced to resign in November amid pressure from the military. Since taking the reins, Mugabe's former deputy, current President Emmerson Mnangagwa, has promised the 2018 elections will be free, fair and credible. He has even said that Western governments and organizations will be allowed to send election observers, something that was unheard of during Mugabe's 37 years in power. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
A huge mound of garbage has collapsed in Mozambique's capital, crushing several homes and killing at least 17 people. Heavy rains are believed to have triggered the collapse in a poor district of Maputo. Authorities say more bodies could still be buried at the Huling garbage dump and that a search is underway. Local media say the trash dump rose to the height of a three-story building. Residents in the area say the garbage dump is full and have long been arguing for its closure. The Huling dump is one of the largest in Maputo. Poor people often search through the garbage heap looking for items to sell.
South Africa's opposition has harshly criticized new President Cyril Ramaphosa's first State of the Nation address, questioning whether the new president had a concrete plan to address the nation's many challenges. A day after taking office to replace the unpopular Jacob Zuma, Ramaphosa's address on Friday outlined big ambitions and challenged South Africans to follow in the steps of the late Nelson Mandela. But yesterday's parliament session gave the opposition an opportunity to poke holes in his vision. Today, Ramaphosa will have a chance to refute the criticisms when he appears in Parliament.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, Cape Town is mired in a three-year drought and is poised to become the world's first major city to run out of water. The city will shut off municipal taps on day zero, currently estimated to happen on June 4th. But for many residents of the city's sprawling low-income townships, water has always been a rare commodity. As residents are being asked to conserve every last drop, some of these residents say they can't tighten their belts much more. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Cape Town.
Ever since she can remember, Pelikazi Rangana has treated water as a precious resource, and not by choice. She has never, in her 53 years, taken a shower. That is because her government-provided home in the impoverished Khayelitsha township does not have an indoor bathroom. For years, she says, she, her husband, child, and grandchild have bathed in the bedroom, using a shallow bucket that holds about 8 liters of water. So the Cape Town resident says she's struggling to understand how some residents of this seaside town are chafing under tight new water restrictions.
It's been not sitting right because in a long time they were the ones who used the water. We are the ones who were not wasting the water. But now it doesn't matter now if we were looking after water. Now it's all of us. We are in the same, like now they are in our shoes.
Rangana's neighbor, Ntombikayi Sedondi, says the drought and water restrictions have hit her hard. She used to have a flourishing home garden. Now she is down to 3 wilted lines of spinach and some sad-looking cauliflower.
This garden makes me cry because I used to feed my family with this garden.
Scientists are still studying the cause of Cape Town's predicament, though they say climate change is a likely culprit for the drought. But the city is also unusually dependent on rainfall, relying on 3 rain-fed dams for all of its water. 3 dry years have almost depleted them. At several natural springs in the city, residents can still fill up water containers for free, up to 25 liters a person. When the city reaches day zero, the day the faucets will run dry, the city plans to set up 200 public water collection points.
We always used to just took water for granted. Now we know what it is to struggle.
That's 70-year-old Jean Gordon, who has lived in Cape Town all her life, near the lush Newlands area. She says she's had to make some unorthodox adjustments to cope.
Shower lifts, sharing the shower with the husband, and
But in poorer areas like Khayelitsha, where many residents have long relied on public taps, the parallels to the unfair apartheid regime are hard to ignore, says local activist and volunteer Mpumi Mklalisi.
The upcoming struggle now will not be a struggle for freedom, but be a struggle for water.
That is a message that haunts many Cape Townians as they face down day zero and an uncertain future. Anita Powell, VOA News, Cape Town.
In the Gambia, the government has launched what it called the National Development Plan for 2018-2021 fiscal year, delivering good governance and accountability, social cohesion, and transformed economy for the well-being of Gambians is high on the agenda. VOA's Pandera Mbai reports.
The National Development Plan is the first of its kind. It is a 4-year program aimed at addressing Gambia's pressing developmental needs. The agenda includes economic empowerment and calls for advancing agriculture, tourism, healthcare, energy, and education. Ismaila Cisse is a political science professor at the University of the Gambia, has reviewed the plan.
First of all, I think it has 2 extremes. One is it is highly ambitious, and the other is it is highly also unambitious. What do I mean by that? At the other end, it is highly ambitious, ideally, in terms of the ideas that are inherent in it. And on the other hand, the financing, they are talking about that they need $2.4 billion to finance it. And I think that's a bit unambitious, considering the work that has to be done.
The Gambia has been designated as a heavily indebted country. Its annual per capita income averages $400. The country depends largely on foreign aid and loans from multilateral institutions. CISA says the National Development Plan mainly focuses on poverty alleviation, and that could be a mistake.
I think what our government should do now is focus more on wealth creation. What strategies, what new economic paradigm, what can we do to ensure that we create wealth that is created locally? We have a lot of resources. Gambia is a resource-rich country. That is why I normally don't buy the idea that Gambia doesn't have any resources. We have the River Gambia, we have the ocean, we have fertile soil, it rains during the rainy season. I mean, there's a lot we can do.
The government says that given the weak economy, it will need external funding support to meet the immediate financing needs of the National Development Plan. It also intends to rely on grants and loans to accomplish the developmental agenda. CISA suggests a different strategy.
For example, we don't produce anything in this country. And if you don't produce anything, you cannot trade, because trade depends on how much you can produce and sell. How much do we produce in this country and we use, and how much of that surplus do we sell to the outside world? And that is the problem. And until and unless we start to think along those lines, our development will be illusion. And as we speak, our development is outsourced at the moment.
When he unveiled the plan, President Adama Barrow underscored its importance.
This goal is anchored on the national vision that aims to transform the Gambia into a country where all citizens enjoy the benefits of the highest standards of governance.
The government says the NDP will be guided by prudent fiscal management and structural reforms that are expected to make the budget leaner and more effective. That includes handling, restructuring debt, and improving revenue collection. For VOA Africa, this is Pandey Mbai reporting.
Police in Yobe State disclosed today that no life was lost in yesterday's attack on a government girls' science secondary school in Busari area of Yobe State by suspected members of Boko Haram. The insurgents attacked the town and carted away foodstuff at the school while firing sporadically, forcing staff and students to flee into surrounding areas for safety. Speaking to newsmen, the Yobe State Commissioner of Police, Abdul Malaki Samanu, said there has been so far no reports of abduction of any of the girls in the school.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation just released its annual letter highlighting the foundation's work and some frequently asked questions. We will discuss this and more next week on Health Chat with our special guest, Hadi Stades, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's country director for Ethiopia. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-691-3111. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, South Africa has a new president, Cyril Ramaphosa. He ascended to the top position after the ruling African National Congress ordered the embattled, scandal-plagued Jacob Zuma to step down as president. We will discuss the implications of the ANC's power shift on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.